Well, hello, all you rambunctious rhinos out there. Welcome to another episode of A Little Greener, a podcast all about nature, conservation, and sustainability. I am one of your hosts, Casey, and I am joined by the incredible Sarah. Sarah, are you feeling rambunctious today as the rhinos?
Not feeling rambunctious today, but I'll work on it. Usually I feel like I start off on a more subdued level for our podcast,
yeah, and then you ramp up.
We work ourselves into a frenzy from there. So maybe by the end, I'll be feeling rambunctious.
Conservation frenzy. How is your week going?
It's going fine. I've transitioned to my new temporary role, so learning lots of things, feeling lots of tired, as I'm sure you are too at this point.
Yes, tired is the word. But I'm ready to keep doing this podcast until this baby's kicking down the door, and then then we'll take a little break.
Dedication.
I'll take a little break.
Dedication. I love it. All right, Casey. Well, I'm just going to go ahead and sort of dive right in, unless do you have any updates or anything from previous week?
No, I mean, it's been beautiful out. So I've been out in the garden a little bit more, picked up some native plants this week. So that's exciting. So I'll just keep hopefully working on that as the sun shines.
Yeah, my mom up in the Midwest got a bunch of plants too. She got some flowers and some food plants.
Yeah.
And I'm extremely jealous. I, of course, have still done nothing, but I'm also down here already sort of past the sort of first planting season for things that I would have wanted to plant in terms of food. So I've got some time to be lazy
or
think and organize. That's better. That's a better thing to say than be lazy. But I have some time until that next round comes about. But I am jealous seeing other people plant and grow some fun things. All right. This week, Casey, we're going to be talking about rhinos. My question for you is, though, more related to our previous jobs. We were both conservation educators. And I'm just curious, if you think back to the beginning of when you got started in conservation education, did you have either a moment that sticks out to you or a thing that you accomplished where you felt like, oh, like, I'm making a difference. Like, this is why I wanted to do this type thing.
Wow. I wish you would have prepped me on this one.
I'm sorry. It's because I didn't think of it until later, or I would have.
Well, it actually was when I started working full-time in conservation education. And there was this family who would come to our job, and they attended a couple of like my talks about animals. And I just got to the point where, like, you know, their kids started to recognize me and would like greet me and tell me their animal stories. And that was just really, really gratifying. You know, I feel like that's the best part of the job in general. It's just seeing kind of the change moments, but kind of having the first time where I was working so consistently in doing what I loved that people recognized me and were excited to see me and wanted to share their passion the way I was sharing mine. That's, I think, the most gratifying. And that family, I think, ended up moving out of the country like shortly thereafter. They were from Africa, but they were just, I think about them often when I see like happy smiling kids, because that's like I hope my kids are that way, like excited to share their passions about things with people.
I love it. And I feel like, you know, when you have a family like that recognizes you and remembers you, it's, you feel like you are having a lasting impact on them. Right? It's not just that they're remembering you, but they care about what you have to say, and you feel like your message is getting across to them. And I feel like that can be a hard thing in conservation education sometimes, because we don't always get to see the same people. And so we don't get those moments very often. So when you do have the chance to see people multiple times like that, I agree. That is a really gratifying moment. And I think those are actually probably the best ones when you have those moments with specific people. One of the things that I remember early on in my career was a project that I got to help make, though. Basically, it was a big puzzle where there was sort of a background image and then image of an animal, which happened to be a rhinoceros. This was an activity for an event celebrating rhinoceroses. And so there was sort of the big backdrop, and then the rhino itself was puzzle pieces. So each piece had a question on it. You would answer the question and kids would put the piece on the puzzle to build the rhino, basically. So they're learning different things as they build the puzzle. And that was just sort of, it was my first real like project in retrospect, looking back. I don't think it was actually that difficult of a thing to create, but it was sort of my first thing as an educator that I got to build and put together and see come to fruition. So even though I actually think yours is the more meaningful moment, like those are the things that I love the most too, is those interactions with people. I think there's a similar type of feeling when I finished that project of, oh, this is a lasting thing that is going to have an impact, hopefully, after I'm not here anymore. And that's the same thing that we hope that we get when we have those interactions with families too. So like I said, it just happened to be an event celebrating the rhinoceros. And that is a project that I think I will forever remember working on. So I have a little bit of a soft spot in my heart for rhinos just from that. And I've been lucky enough to get to see them up close occasionally up throughout my line of work too, which is also pretty fun. So they're cool animals. We're going to spend today talking a little bit about different types of rhinos and some of the issues that they're facing in the wild. So stick around for that. All right, everyone, welcome to our discussion on rhinos. This episode was brought to you by listener request, although I did kind of wait specifically until this time of year to talk about it, because if you follow animal or conservation groups on the internet, or if you have people on your social media feeds who do, in the past week or so, you may have noticed a little bit of an uptick in rhinoceros content because we just passed the 5th of May, and that has sort of become a little bit of an unofficial day to celebrate and raise awareness for rhinos, the fifth day of the fifth month, to recognize the five species of rhino. Casey, we have talked in the past about animals like the red panda, for example, that have kind of gotten a popularity boost from sort of mainstream culture. I feel like maybe the same is true with rhinos a little bit. Those Save the Chubby Unicorn t-shirts and things like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's like specific to us because we've worked in conservation organizations and that became like something you'd find in the gift shop. But yeah, the chubby unicorns is a fun moniker for them for sure.
And they're an iconic animal regardless. This is an animal that people are going to know if you say the name. But I think a lot of times people maybe don't know the full picture when it comes to rhinos. So let's talk about it. Casey, what would be your sort of just general, how would you describe a rhino to somebody?
Alien pops down on Earth and I've got to describe how to find the rhino. Okay.
For a second, I thought you were starting to describe them by alien. Saying it. I was like, I don't know if I agree with that.
But no, there's much more, sloths are much more alien than rhinoceros. So I would say that they are like a very bulky, robust animal, regardless of the species. They're like very heavy bodied with fairly short legs. More athletic looking than like a hippo, for example.
Okay.
You know, like a hippo is like smooth and rhinos look like they would, I don't know, be more like a linebacker for football than like the just like chillness of the hippo, even though personality wise, not really accurate. And then they've got sort of a long face, ears that can turn in different directions because hearing is very important, smaller eyes, and then a horn, maybe two horns, depending on the species.
Beautiful. Gosh, as always, a much better description than I would have given. But yeah, I think that's a pretty good general overall depiction covering the five species that we're going to talk about, although there are some fairly substantial differences between those five species. So these are large animals. They are the second largest land animals after elephants. They are plant eating animals. These big old animals are strictly herbivores. They are known for those horns that you mentioned, either one or two, which we'll talk about, made out of the protein keratin, same stuff that's in our hair and fingernails. They're part of a group of animals called odd-toed ungulates, along with our equids, so our horses and zebras, yeah. And tapirs are also in that group. And all those animals, in addition to, of course, having that odd number of toes, they're also hindgut fermenters, which just has to do with how they digest their food, different from, like, the ruminants, say, for example, that are, like, cows and goats and giraffes and all of that. So that's kind of the big picture of our rhinos. I feel like when people think of rhinos, they think Africa, and they think of the African species, right?
Absolutely. I'm sure, like, you can imagine rhinos amongst the animals at Simba's coronation in The Lion King. Like, that's sort of where I feel like people picture them, is, like, amongst that cast.
They do, yes. Yeah. They have the rhinos bowing down there at the beginning and then, yes, for sure. Good call. So yeah, that's what people think of. And I would guess that if people were getting specific enough, what they're thinking of when they think of the rhino is actually the species known as the white rhino, which is one of our two African species. This species, the white rhino, so we're just going to kind of go through our five species. The white rhino, along with another one of the species that we'll talk about later, is considered the largest. Depends on who you ask which one is larger. They're pretty comparable. So it's one of the largest. They can be up to about 6,000 pounds. And they have the big sort of wide, flat mouth. I mentioned that rhinos are herbivores. They do still eat slightly different things. Our white rhinos are what we call grazers. So they're going to be using that wide flat mouth to mow down some grasses out there on the African savanna, which is where they live. These guys are actually not technically chubby unicorns because they do have two horns, one horn. Yep.
They're also not white, guys. They're gray, in case you're like picturing that.
Yeah. What you will hear most often for the reason that they're called white rhino is that it was maybe a misunderstanding of the word for wide, but
my understanding is that it's not actually backed up. Yeah, it's kind of just one of those, like, urban legends that sort of sounds like a fact, so everybody says it. But I had to do research about this a couple years ago, and I was like, actually, there seems to be nothing that says that that's actually
it's a possibility, but nobody really knows. And I did read one article suggesting that it's rather unlikely, actually, that's the case. But it's a theory that's out there. We don't really know. The next species we're going to talk about is the black rhino. So
they're different.
They're a different species. They're the same color, though. So there are some other theories out there if you're interested. So these guys do have two horns. That front horn is the big horn. They can be over 6 feet.
That's crazy. I've never seen a rhino with a horn that long, but I have seen some pretty gnarly ones, like some pretty long horns.
You can find some pictures on the internet. I have certainly never seen in person a front horn anywhere close to that, but it does just remind me that usually, like I said, I have gotten to be up close, certainly with a barrier in between, but up close to rhinos a couple of times. But most of the time when I'm seeing a rhino, you're a fair distance away. And so I think sometimes I forget just really how big they are, because that's a pretty impressive, again, maximum length. They're not all going to get that big.
I Googled it. These long-horned rhinos look like dinosaurs. Like they look disproportionate.
The back horns tend to be less than 2 feet long, so they're much smaller. You will typically hear white rhinos described as the most social of the species. So that's another difference between some of our rhino species. Described as semi-social, though, it's typically going to be the females and the younger ones that are more social, and the males are still going to have their territories. As far as reproduction goes, this is actually pretty consistent among all of the species, but it's worth noting that females basically only have one calf. every 2 to 3 years. So we're going to talk a lot about conservation and these animals. And we've mentioned many times before that that's a contributing factor when you have these bigger animals with slower reproduction rates. Anything that affects their population is going to be harder to come back from. So that's important to note. And speaking of conservation of these animals, right now they are listed by the IUCN as near threatened, with a population sitting around 16,000. And just so you know, for numbers and populations, and actually most of the info that I'm sharing this evening, I'm looking at both the IUCN and also one of the major rhino conservation organizations, the International Rhino Foundation. So they have a lot of good content on their website and try to stay pretty updated with the numbers there as well. And I was actually a little bit surprised by that, Casey. I just had to double check it because those numbers were a little bit lower than I feel like I remembered them being actually. But this particular species of rhino is oftentimes described as a conservation success story. And we'll see as we go through the rest of the species compared to these other ones, 16,000 is a high number with what we're going to see later. But at one point, by the end of like the 19th century, so going way back, their population had dropped as low as an estimated like 20 to 50 individuals left.
And so this has to do with hunting, right, yes. Sarah? Like, this is not like, oh, a natural disaster wiped them out. Correct. Like, humans went after them. This is like kind of a bison situation.
Absolutely. And so then it's, you know, a lot of dedicated protection and a lot of time. By 2015, their population had rebounded to around 20,000, which I think was still the number that I kind of had in my brain. It was that we were over 20,000 with them. So we've dropped a little bit from that peak in 2015. And it is important to say, too, that within this species, we do have two subspecies, because people may be familiar with this from the news as well. What we're really talking about with these numbers is the subspecies known as the southern white rhino, the northern white rhino. There's two individuals left, both females. Yep. So this would be generally described as functionally extinct. However, this is the whole episode in and of itself. There are still thoughts and folks considering attempting to bring this subspecies back using stored egg and sperm cells that we have and using IVF, basically, for the species. So there's lots to unpack there. Do you have any quick thoughts that you wanted to share
well,
on that, Casey?
I would say like a couple years ago, the last male passed. Mm-hmm. I do believe he was possibly related to the last females as well. If I remember correctly, when he passed, there was a bunch of stories. It's kind of like when you see stories being like the Great Barrier Reef is dead, where it's like, it's not, I mean, there's a lot more hope for the Great Barrier Reef than there is for the northern white rhino. But when he passed away, they basically were like, yeah, this species is going to be extinct. But that was probably true for a lot longer than just after the male passed. Like they're
right.
That's a very small population to be coming back from. So yes, there is a lot of money and publicity that's put into like cloning and resurrecting the species. You'll see it kind of along the lines of the woolly mammoth. Oh, we could bring the woolly mammoth back.
Right.
I have a lot of complicated thoughts about it, but for the most part, we can basically assume that within the next 10 to 15 years that we will not have any individuals left.
Yeah.
If these guys are towards or mature towards the top of their lifespan.
Yeah. And I just feel like this is me personally not honestly having looked much into it for the purposes of this episode. I just sort of feel like this maybe is not the thing that we want to be spending time
when you have limited resources in conservation. It does feel like a bit of a money hole to be pouring them down when we've got four other species we're about to talk about and a whole other subspecies for within this group as well. I would also say that like one of the challenges for this subspecies in general is that its habitat is in more of like central northern Africa versus the southern white rhino, which is in truly southern Africa. Mm-hmm. And that area just doesn't have the resources and has generalized right. political instability that even if you brought the population back, keeping them protected from threats is just like a very cost ineffective endeavor itself.
I agree with that. And we'll probably bring that up again later on too. All right. So that's the white rhino in a nutshell. Let's move on to that other African species that we mentioned, the black rhino. There's actually three subspecies within this species as well. The black rhino is smaller, really significantly smaller than the white rhino. They max out closer to 3,000 pounds. And I have a little picture for your enjoyment on each of these species. Casey, once again, mm-hmm. folks, if you're listening, Google it if you're not familiar with the species. But one of the distinguishing traits of the black rhino as compared to the white rhino is the shape of their mouth. So we mentioned that wide, flat mouth for our white rhinos. Black rhinos have a pointed upper lip. So they are called browsers rather than grazers. So rather than those large amounts of grasses, they are going to be more adept to pulling leaves off of trees and shrubs with their little pointed lip. And it's rather adorable, honestly.
Yeah.
They are more solitary than the white rhino, and that's certainly how I've always had it described to me, is that black rhinos are more solitary, although according to the International Rhino Foundation, they're not as solitary as they are often portrayed, but females are still going to have overlapping ranges, so they're not completely solitary, but relatively speaking, more solitary. And once again, females are just going to be having one calf every 2.5 to 3 years. This species is currently classified by the IUCN as critically endangered, with a little over 3,000 mature individuals, according to IUCN. Interestingly, though, locally, in some parts of their range, their population has grown too large for carrying capacity in the area. So part of their conservation work that's being done with them is sometimes having to translocate individuals to a different area that can sustain that larger population. And as far as I can tell, there is also still legal sport hunting of black rhinos in Namibia and South Africa, which does raise some money for conservation efforts and local communities, which again is a whole nother discussion within and of itself. But that was really interesting to me. It's just hard for me to read about sometimes, like, this, it is a critically endangered species. If we can relocate them, let's relocate them instead of hunting them. But that is, it is a very limited number. I think it's 10, I think, in South Africa, maybe, individuals is the allotment.
Yeah, the argument there is that it costs a lot of money to protect these animals. And it does. And so by allowing a very small number to be legally hunted, you are going to take the money raised from that and put it back into conservation. I think that is still an ethical, interesting zone.
Yes.
But also, I'm not the one needing to raise money for rhino conservation or living near rhino land. So,
yeah, it does seem to raise a lot of money. Again, I don't want to speak too heavily on it because I didn't research it in depth enough to comment. So what I can say is that I know that it can raise a substantial amount of money, and it still makes me very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. There we go. Perhaps more to come in a future episode. Those are the ones that people are going to be aware of. But we actually have three more species of rhino that are our Asian rhinoceros, which I think, I don't know, I would imagine, maybe I'm just projecting unfairly onto people, but if you pulled 10 people off the street, that over half of them would not realize that rhinos lived outside of Africa.
If I was on a, like, I don't know, Billy on the Street situation where someone was like, quick, where are rhinos from? I'd be like, Africa! I wouldn't think about Asia. But yes, the lesser known species are in Asia.
Yes. So let's start. We'll start with the largest one here that I alluded to earlier that are comparable in size with our white rhino, and that is the greater one-horned rhino. These are the chubby unicorns right here, because these guys can weigh up to about 6,000 pounds, again, comparable to our white rhino, and they do just have the one horn. They are found in grasslands and wetlands in India and Nepal, and are also, like the white rhinos, considered a conservation success story, once numbering at less than 100 due to sport hunting, again, and also habitat conversion, so a lot of loss of land to agricultural lands. And now the species numbers at over 4,000. Something interesting that came up about this species, though, too, obviously we're going to be talking about poaching. We've already mentioned hunting several times. Right now, it looks like populations for the greater one-horned rhino are actually currently increasing, which is great to hear. But one of the threats that they're facing, which I didn't really see related to other species, is that they're losing habitat to invasive species, which we've done a couple of episodes on. But I feel like when I talk about invasive species and habitat disruption and some of the issues that invasive species can cause, I don't typically think of them contributing that much to a large animal's detriment, if that makes sense.
You think of them like out competing native plant other species, plants, yeah. Or if they're like a small mammal, like
right, a birds. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and again, you know, how much of a threat this currently is to the species, maybe that's debatable. Like I said, right now their populations are currently increasing. But again, according to IUCN, the species is inherently at risk because over 70% of its population occurs at a single site in a particular national park. Yeah. We've talked about that before, the dangers of sort of isolated populations. The area that they're in is subject to poaching, human wildlife conflict around them as well. And so this sort of invasive species perhaps taking over their habitat is, you know, it's just one more thing just piling it on that can make it tough for them. I also just want to say too, and I think maybe I was going to mention this later, but I'll say it here, poaching just feels like it is the swinging axe over this whole thing. Like, even for these species that are not currently in decline, or species that are doing have been doing worse and rebounded, it just feels like everything is always based on how bad the threat of poaching currently is, and that just seems to swing back and forth. But it just feels like reading through IUCN for basically every species, like I said, even if they're doing well now, they still mention this is still hanging over our heads here. The threat of poaching is still hanging over. And if that changes, everything could turn for these animals.
Yeah, I think of like Mad-Eye Moody in Harry Potter, where he's like, constant vigilance.
Exactly.
And that's, yeah, that is extremely necessary. Even if it's not happening at this moment, you feel like the other foot is always about to drop and be like, when you're talking, but you're also playing with very small numbers. When we're talking about populations that are in the thousands rather than the like hundreds of thousands, when you kill a couple hundred animals a year, that has a bigger population dent. Like it truly is, one year to the next could swing the pendulum
right
either way. I just used a lot of mixed metaphors, but yes.
I'm following you. All right. So for whatever that's worth, there it is. Just it is a thing that just we constantly need to keep in mind with these animals. Casey, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misremembering, greater one-horned rhinos, you might have the potential to see at a zoological institution in the United States, right? There's some zoos that have them.
I put my hand inside a mouth of
look at you! One-horned
rhino. So I know they have them, for example, at the Wilds, which is a conservation facility, kind of safari zoo experience in Ohio. And yes, so there is a breeding population. You definitely see a lot more of the white rhinos in at least U.S. human care. But yes, you could potentially see one around.
So depending on where you're listening from, you may be like, oh my gosh, what is she talking about? Of course we know about the greater one.
Right.
So that you can find them at a zoo, which cool. If you've got one nearby, you go check it out. these last couple of species that we're going to talk about, you will not see in a zoo. You will not see if you travel to their country of origin. You're not going to see them. So the first is the Javan rhino. And I should have mentioned this with the greater one-horned rhino, in addition to their one horn and their large size. I feel like the distinguishing thing about the greater one-horned rhino is that they really look like they're wearing armor to me. Like, they have those sort of really big, yes, distinctive skin folds. Yeah, that almost just look like plates of armor. And the Javan rhino has that too, perhaps even more distinctively.
Yes. And almost like pebbling, it almost like on some of the folds. So it really does feel like if you had a D&D character wearing armor, that they would have like a similar sort of like armor texture.
Yeah. So these animals are up to about 5,000 pounds, so a little smaller than our greater one horns. Once again, only one horn, so also little chubby unicorns. Smaller horns too. I was reading for the males, it's only up to about 10 inches long, and smaller or non-existent on the females, which made me wonder if they were perhaps less susceptible to poaching, but guess not so much.
Nah.
Still a threat for them. Their diet is pretty varied. They are browsers as well, like we talked about with our black rhino, but they have a really varied diet of over like 300 known species of plants that these guys will eat. They are also a solitary animal. They are also only found in one place, one population, in Indonesia, with a population of an estimated 76 individuals. So this is one of the most endangered species that you are going to hear about. 76 individuals. The good news, I guess, relatively speaking, is that right now the population is considered stable, with a birth every year. And to be honest, I don't know if that is up to and including, I don't know how far up exactly that's going. But since 2012, they've had a pretty good string of births. So that's good. Like we talked about, slow birth rate. If you're not seeing births, we know we're going to be in trouble. 76 is a really low number, but we've seen our greater one horns. We've seen our white rhinos come back from low numbers. So if we can get good protection, if we can get good reproduction going, that's a positive thing. Their long-term decline to this number of 76, once again, is likely largely due to poaching. Now we're more concerned about, I shouldn't say more concerned, right now we are also very concerned about available habitat. Once again, we're dealing with that one population issue, making them really vulnerable. But unlike, say, what we were talking about with the black rhino of being able to translocate animals.
Right.
Where else do we put these animals? They're, again, this is the Javan rhino. They're living in a small island nation.
Yes, the Indonesian archipelago habitat loss is such a huge issue based on the population and the resources needed, and also, honestly, growing conditions for lots of crops around. But yes, these guys are, I mean, the last two species we talked about too, their populations are in national parks, like they're in protected areas. That doesn't mean that you're in a safe bubble entirely, but at least it means that there's like, this is not going to be readily developed as much as a private land, but still faces a lot of the similar challenges as if they were just out in, I was going to say the wild, which they are in the wild. They are in also a human
protected area in the wild.
In the wild.
Yeah. And there's just not a lot of space to go beyond that. So that's a challenge for them. But I'm choosing to hold on to the positive right now that at least currently it seems like their population is stable. So that's better than going in the other direction. One more species left. Casey, do you have a favorite rhino species?
I don't. You know I like fuzzy things. So, yeah. I mean, the Sumatran rhino that's coming up. I can't say it's my favorite because honestly, I don't know enough about it to like make a case other than that aesthetically it's very
I was going to say, I'm showing you the picture. How much more info do you need? This is definitely my favorite species of rhino. It's just so distinct from the other ones. They're the smallest. They're only like up to 2,000 pounds, which I know 2,000 pounds is big, but not when you're comparing it to 6,000 pounds. It's a little fuzzy rhino.
It is. And I do want to say you will not find them in zoos in the U.S.
You will not find them.
But you could up until 2015. Yes. Cincinnati Zoo had a breeding program for Sumatran rhinos.
Yes.
Are we going to get to that?
We are going to get to that.
Okay, yes. Cool.
Yes, but no, that's a great point. Yes, so you won't see them anymore in zoos, but some of you may have been fortunate enough. I do not recall getting to see them, which
bummer.
Is a bummer. Yeah, but they are dang cute, and that we're talking about it, but they are hairy. They are actually, the hairy rhinoceros is another name that you will hear for these animals. Look them up if you've never seen one. I picked, I feel like, an exceptionally hairy photo to show yes. you there, but they're small and hairy. And I think that just makes them more adorable to me. There's less than 50 of them left. So we're looking at, I think the most current estimates are anywhere from 34 to 46 individuals. And here's where, so we've been talking about the risks of having one isolated population, right? Anything that rips through, disease, natural disaster, whatever, could just entirely decimate that one population. So we don't want one, especially one small population, but we also don't want a whole bunch of teeny, teeny, tiny populations that can't access each other. And that's kind of the situation that we have going on with the Sumatran rhino. Even when they are well protected from poaching, having such a small population, fragmented population, these animals aren't going to be able to find each other to breed. You can't reproduce if you can't find each other.
They're not. And my understanding about rhino reproduction is that basically it's a use it or lose it situation for the females. Like, it becomes more challenging if they haven't had access to a male for many, many years for them to then conceive another baby. So like, time is of the essence. It's not just like find a lady and find a male and pop them together.
That's actually really interesting. I didn't come across that, but there definitely have been challenges with reproduction for these. So in terms of Sumatran rhinos in particular, at this point, human intervention is a necessity. So we have to help manage these animals. So there is actually a Sumatran rhino sanctuary in Indonesia. This is cooperation between the Indonesian government, NGOs, both in Indonesia and around the world, including the International Rhino Foundation. So they built this. It's a 250-acre sanctuary that was built back in 1996. It got expanded in 2019, and I think there's plans to have a couple more. So in that time, since 1996, three calves have been born at the reserve. And three calves, exciting. Each one is very exciting, but three calves since 1996. There was one female born last year to a first-time mom, also very exciting, after eight lost pregnancies by this female. So obviously we've got more to learn. And, you know, I don't know how much is, you know, what you were just talking about, Casey, but reproduction is a struggle for them, even in managed care. Another cool thing about the birth, though, of this, and I couldn't see in what I was looking at a name for this little calf that was born last year, but her mom's name is Rosa, and her father is a rhino called Undatu, who was the first calf ever born at the sanctuary. So I thought that was really cool that rhino that was born at the sanctuary is now father to another little calf. So that's, to me, feels like a really good sign of progress. And I guess maybe I didn't put it in here, Casey, so I'm glad you brought it up earlier, but a couple of the rhinos at this sanctuary came over from the Cincinnati Zoo. So you can actually go on I believe it's the International Rhino Foundation's website, or there may be a separate website for the sanctuary. Either way, I'll link to it in the show notes, but you can actually go on and read the profiles of each of the individual rhinos. I think there's 9 now, including this calf that was just born, and you can read about them on the website. And so that is, yeah, I think a cool and important thing that the zoo did in sending those rhinos over to the sanctuary. Help make some babies.
We need some rhino babies out there, not just because they're adorable.
Let's talk a little bit, kind of summarize the threats and the solutions that we're dealing with here. Obviously, Sumatran rhinos, there is a plan. And again, cooperation with the Indonesian government, they're in. Everybody's working together to protect these animals. There are dedicated rhino protection units on the ground, folks whose job it is to specifically keep these animals safe from poachers. And then obviously you've got the care teams and the folks that are working to help get these babies born, and all of those things going on with the Sumatran rhino. But for every species, poaching remains a huge issue. And like I was saying, even when it's not the current biggest threat for a species, it still just sort of feels like everything else hangs on it, and our ability to keep it from not returning to being the biggest threat for that species. For example, IUCN actually says on their website that the reason that they currently assess the white rhino as near threatened rather than least concern continues to be the continued and high poaching threat and illegal demand for horn, in particular Southeast Asia, increased involvement of organized international criminal syndicates in rhino poaching, and protection efforts depend on significant range state expenditure and effort. And if these were to decline, rampant poaching could seriously threaten numbers well in excess of 30% over 3 generations, which is one of the criteria that they use to make their population assessments. So basically, poaching is expensive to stop, and if we stop being able to protect them, their fear is that those numbers would just decline extremely rapidly.
Yeah, I feel like maybe something that we've been alluding to, rather than just to say it straight out loud, rhinos are specifically poached for their horns, which, as we've established, is made out of keratin. It is not special. It is the same thing as your fingernails and hair. I mean, all of them are genetically different, obviously, but right. It is, as far as like actual medicinal value, which is one of the reasons that is ascribed to poaching, it doesn't necessarily care, like there's no proven benefit from it, but it does drive a lot of poaching money, crime, and it is illegal to trade internationally those horns. So it is not just a like, oh, we should really ban all this, like it's already banned, it's just right. Happening.
Yep. And it is particularly high demand in China and Vietnam are the 2 countries. I say that with the caveat that that happens to be true for rhino horn. Everybody around the world, you know, wildlife crime, wildlife trafficking happens globally, including right here in the United States.
Absolutely.
We have, you know, look past in our history, and there are many species that we've driven to near extinction because of things like fashion and that type of thing, you know,
absolutely.
Things like bird feathers, alligators, you know, before laws were changed and things got turned around. So, but that is the fact of the matter, that that's where the highest demand is for rhino horn. And it is in part for this perceived medicinal use, which, as you said, there is no evidence to back up. And it has also become a status symbol as well, in particular for the wealthy to have rhino horn. And it's interesting, I couldn't find a lot of stats in terms of how much of each one of those is kind of driving demand, but those are definitely noted as the 2 biggest driving factors. And so it's hard. Let's talk about kind of control and what's being done. Obviously, you mentioned this is already illegal to trade internationally. So we have protection, we have laws in place, we have protected areas for these animals. And in some cases, we have those dedicated rhino protection units, anti-poaching units. All of this requires government support. all of this requires a lot of money.
And you've just talked about two of the major places where they are in demand are not their range states. So right. It is coming from places that are not necessarily like experiencing any sort of, not any sort of, but there's an economical factor that the places that need to protect them are also not the places where the horn is going.
Right. And so I would say those are probably kind of the traditional things that are done, right? We're making our laws, we're establishing protected areas, we're getting boots on the ground. We are seeing other things try to come into this argument as well. Things that I remember hearing about in the past are, well, let's just dehorn the rhinos.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like an elephant where, you know, you can't take out an elephant's tusk, you know what I mean? Like, we still have to anesthetize the rhinos, but we can basically just take off the bulk of the rhino horn. There's a lot to me. I mean, maybe you first hear that and you're like, oh yeah, like that's a creative solution. But there's a lot of question marks around that sort of immediately make it not feasible. First of all, this would have to be done every 12 to 24 months because you're not taking off the full horn. You can't do
that. It's a fingernail sort of situation. Yeah.
It's going to grow back. And so in order to keep that horn debulked, this would have to be a repeated process. There's stress on the animal. There's the number of animals that you'd be doing this to.
It's also very expensive.
Yeah. What then do you do with that horn?
Yeah. I mean, there are programs that grind them down into mm-hmm. dust, basically, to make them unvaluable. And then there's also the idea that you can stockpile them.
Yeah. I feel like to me, there's still just the danger of that horn making it out into the system, if you will, I guess, because I think it is ground a lot of times too. I think sometimes it does get ground and like that's, it's rhino horn powder is what gets used medicinally.
In pills. Yeah.
So,
but as far as like trading, a lot of times, the horn itself.
No, I get it. Yeah. And the other thing is that those poachers may still kill an animal. Like if you were a poacher and you tracked a rhino only to find that rhino and discover that it had had the bulk of its horn taken off, you might just kill it anyway. And there is some evidence out there that dehorning rhinos would not be effective just in part for that reason, that they're going to get killed anyway. There is an article from another conservation organization called Save the Rhino that talks about rhinos that were dehorned in a national park in Zimbabwe during the early 1990s. And it said that the majority of the dehorned rhinos were killed within 12 to 18 months after being dehorned.
Yeah, rhino horn is so insanely valuable that if you were going to kill a, like, obviously you want to kill a rhino that has a bigger horn if you're a poacher trying to make your most money, but also you can still make money off of a little bit of horn.
Right.
So the studies I did find about black rhinos is that, I mean, rhinos have their horn to help protect themselves from predators. They use them to socialize and combat, but they didn't find any sort of impact on quality of life for black rhinos that were dehorned. So from a rhino's perspective, that's good.
I guess. Yeah. It does seem interesting to me, though, that an animal that could have, I guess not the black rhino specifically, but if some species of rhinos can have up to 6 foot long horns.
Sure.
That it feels like it's got to make some sort of a difference if you just take them away too. So, but the long and the short of it is this seems like a very labor and cost heavy solution that clearly does not eliminate the need for anti-poaching protection still. So I feel like that can be really eliminated in my mind, honestly, as even part of the solution. Casey, did you hear about or have you come across to anything about dyeing rhino horns?
I've heard about dyeing rhino horns a little bit and also the creation of synthetic rhino horn to flood the market.
Yeah, and I didn't even go into that too much. Yeah, so there is work on creating synthetic rhino horn, which you could go into some pros and cons of that. It feels to me, the reading that I did on that, is that there is still just debate that people don't know how it will affect the market, whether it would you know, make it sort of too common and therefore less valuable, or whether it would just keep ramping up that demand and right. make the problem even worse. But there's also things to consider, like if you've got synthetic rhino horn that is that good, that is that, you know, how are you going to sort through the legalities of that? You know, what are TSA agents or, you know, whatever at the border right. is going to do? How are they going to be able to distinguish synthetic from real?
If the people who are very highly invested in making sure they have real rhino horn can't tell the difference, then how is, yeah, what's the regulating mechanism on that one?
Right. So that it seems tough to me, although potentially still part of the solution. But the dying and or devaluing, that's really what the dying was getting at. There are some articles that you can pull up that show like rhinos with neon pink horns that are so fairly clearly photoshopped, it's not even funny. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about dyeing, but they were talking about infusing dye into the horn as part of devaluing it to make it not worth it for folks who are maybe wanting it as a status symbol, but also potentially rendering it useless for medicinal purposes or for intended medicinal purposes. But also some of the things that I was reading that went along with that were talking about infusing the horns with like a poison, basically. I'm forgetting actually.
Oh my.
So you're like, oh, it wouldn't kill a person, but in low doses, it would make them sick. And so what they were talking about doing is having this done to rhinos in certain areas. So this right. might be done on a rhino who lives on privately owned land, for example, which Casey, you and I were chatting about this before the episode, potentially as much as over half of rhinos in Africa do live on private or community lands, which does not necessarily mean the rhinos are privately owned. Different countries have different laws and regulations about whether you can own rhinos as a private owner or whether you are sort of a steward or a custodian of those rhinos that are on your land. Anyway, this was talking about rhinos in a certain place that were then protected, and signage was put up basically saying that this has been done to the rhino horn. So it's basically like, poachers beware, this rhino horn is worthless to you, which that part of it was kind of interesting to me. I cannot get behind poisoning anybody.
I think that there is a bias in the US to be like, oh, people believe this thing. Guys, how many fad diets have have been on who promises that just like drinking just celery juice
yeah.
or like the powers of essential oils being exaggerated beyond mm-hmm. bounds. Can you imagine if that person in your life got poisoned?
Yeah.
It just sounds so horrible. Like it's just such a horrible thought to me. And like, again, I doubt that we would see the sort of impact at scale that they would want to deter poaching entirely from rhinos. Yeah.
But I like the idea of sort of a bluffing about it.
Sure.
If you just sort of started saying, like putting up signs everywhere, like, this rhino horn will make you sick. Like, I wonder what kind of effect that would have if we just started seeing that signage. You know, I've always been like, I don't need a home security system. I just need the sign in my window that says,
yeah, yeah. I think you need like an Oprah or equivalent person to like tell you about the dangers to get it to like the masses rather than your local poacher being like, I couldn't bring home some rhino horn because it was poisoned.
Yeah, so I can't get behind that. I'll have links in the show notes if you're curious about reading more about these things. There is maybe something there to be said for if there was something that we could do to just devalue a horn. I don't know what I have no logical way that could work, but I do like the idea of finding a way to devalue it. And then of course there are awareness campaigns like that. We are conservation educators. That has to be part of it. and conservation organizations have been working to reduce demand through awareness and education. I wish that I could have found more specifics. Because I feel like I remember in the recesses of my brain, I don't know if it was specifically related to rhino or if this was maybe ivory, that generationally the demand has decreased over the years. I couldn't find it. I couldn't find a lot of statistics. I think it's hard to get statistics with things like this sometimes because people aren't always going to be open about sharing.
Yes. I mean, like, we're talking about something that's largely illegal in many parts of the world. I did mention, like, Oprah, Jackie Chan and Yao Ming have both been part of these awareness campaigns, which is basically Oprah in that context with trying to reduce trade for ivory and rhino horn and shark fin, which, I would definitely want to look more into those studies of what we know about that.
Yeah. But I guess where I was sort of going with that is, like, I think that there has been positive steps with those awareness campaigns, but it is sort of hard too, right? This is a traditional medicine belief that gets handed down generationally. So at least from that side of it, and again, we see those things, you know, wherever you are listening from, you've probably seen medical information, incorrect medical information get put out there, and the number of people that buy into it, you know, and that's just, you know, that's not even something as deeply personal as a belief that's been passed down culturally. So
I feel like I get influenced by Pinterest telling me what I should and shouldn't eat during pregnancy, like, let alone what your grandma told you is, like, been effective in our family for generations. That's a hard one.
So, and I think it is hard too. Like, you don't want to be an outside source either coming in, which is why it is so great to have folks like Yao Ming in, you know, on this too. But I think it's hard. And even as a conservation educator, I feel like we have to figure out a different way or a different spin on the message or something. Like, you know, I don't know what the most effective message here is for the particular issues that we're facing here.
Well, and I think as ground level conservation educators, the audience that you and I have reached historically or even now are not the, like, we don't know how to communicate this message most effectively, partially because we're just not part of that audience of people.
Right. So there's a lot. Poaching is, I think, a known issue for a lot of people, but hopefully this maybe broadened horizons to see some of the more, the complexities of the issue. Hopefully maybe now you have some awareness of the other species that maybe you weren't familiar with and some of the things facing them. Casey, I realize now why I put things in the order that I did on this outline. I wanted to end with the positive and then I did things out of order. So now, instead of ending on positive Sumatran rhino baby news and ending with frustration on not knowing how to change minds out there. But just remember, yes, there are positive things happening. Do yourself a favor, look up a picture of that baby Sumatran rhino that was born at the reserve last year. And that, if nothing else, will lift your spirits. There are signs of hope within rhinos. Yes, we have these critically endangered species. We also have a couple of species that have been back from the brink. It's a different time. The issues aren't exactly the same. Habitat, almost even more than poaching, feels like the bigger issue to me with the success of bringing some of these species numbers back up. But I do think that there's some hopeful things to look for in the rhino world.
Co-signed.
Agree. All right. Stick around, folks. We will wrap things up and give you some challenges for the week after this. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoyed learning about those five species of rhino. We have a few challenges, action items for you this week. The first is that we sort of give you the big picture overview of those five species. Choose your favorite. Doesn't have to be the Sumatran, even though I don't know how you pick against them. But choose your favorite. Learn a little more about your favorite species of rhino, however you want to do it. Maybe that is looking online. Again, you can use our show notes, our resources to see some of the things that we were looking at. But find your source. Get a book from your library. Go to your local zoo if you've got a rhino species there. However you want to do it, learn more about your favorite species. The second one is, we try not to ask you to all the time just donate, but we've said multiple times during this episode, it is expensive. It is expensive to protect these animals. There are some great organizations that you can find out there where you can donate to support the protection of rhinos. So if you've got a little extra money, you're looking to do some good with some money, this is definitely one avenue that you can look for to donate to help with conservation efforts for our rhino species. And then the last one is one that we've mentioned before with other species, other episodes, but think about palm oil in your products. Just be mindful when you do your grocery shopping this week. See if you can avoid palm oil in your groceries or look for items that are using sustainable palm oil. We think about that. The orangutan is the poster child for palm oil, but our, Indonesia is a huge producer of palm oil, and we have our two species, our Javan and Sumatran rhinos that come from that part of the world, and habitat loss being part of the contributing factor. Let's do what we can to help protect some habitats in that part of the world.
Everything's interconnected, even though I think a lot of us are a little farther away from this particular like looming threat for this species. We all kind of contribute in our own little way. So we can make a positive difference on this one. And thanks for talking about rhinos this week, Sarah. I think we're going to do a little bit of a tangent conversation next week too. So I look forward to potentially continuing talking about rhinos as well. So long as I don't have a baby.
Yeah, that's important. Also, I mentioned at the beginning that this was an episode by request. I will come clean here and tell you that this episode was requested by my mother. And I will tell you that because it's going to come out on Mother's Day weekend. Oh, so happy Mother's Day, Mom. I'm sure this is exactly what you wanted. Gave you your episode on rhinos. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope all of you enjoyed it. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, suggestions for future episodes, you don't have to be related to me to get your episode out there. Please let us know. You can find us everywhere. We're on Facebook. You can find us at A Little Greener Podcast. We're on Instagram at A Little Greener Pod. We are on Twitter at A Greener Podcast. And you can send us an email at alittlegreenerpodcast@gmail.com. We are always happy to hear from you.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.